You're listening to Spellbound. Welcome to episode 18 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android. I'm joined today by Jonathan Hurst. Jonathan, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Jonathan, you are quite an impressive dude. You have a bachelor's in mechanical engineering, a master's in robotics, and a PhD in robotics from Carnegie Mellon University, and you are the chief technology officer and co-founder of Agility Robotics.
Yeah, thank you.
So how long have you guys been going over at Agility? It's a pretty new venture for you guys, right?
It's a pretty new venture. I'd say we started operations in terms of having a location and having our first employee just at the very end of 2016, the beginning of 2017. So about a year and a half that we've been operating now. But all of this work is growing from and built on the research done in my laboratory at Oregon State University. I'm a professor there, and I've been doing the research in legged locomotion and proving out some of the science of legged locomotion in the academic environment. And then this is licensing that technology. Our company is building from the technology we've been creating at the university.
So Agility actually started out in a university, and then you guys have taken your work there into the marketplace, and it's going pretty well, right? You guys just got like a big round of funding and everything, and it seems to be going pretty well for you guys.
Yeah, we just closed our Series A. We've got a really great team and growing, and you know, it's the sort of situation where walking and running, it's not a solved problem. It's not something that the scientific or engineering community, knows how to do really well. If it was known, we'd have robots walking and running around outside because there's all kinds of use cases for it. So there are a lot of challenges, not just the science, but the engineering best practices. And we're at the position now with our team and with the funding and so on. We have the opportunity to really show what we can do and to really try to tackle that problem. And can't ask for a better opportunity than that.
So why build robots? What drew you to this initially?
Oh, I've always been excited about this. I don't know. Imagining something that is agile and moves quickly and does things that normally you only see animals able to do, but you see something you created, a machine being able to do that thing or something like it is just an exciting thing that really, I think, spoke to me as a seven-year-old. But moving on throughout my career, it's also interesting how little we know about how to do that and also how much progress has been made over the past, I don't know, 10, 20 years, how much people are learning. And so it's a really exciting place to be technically as an engineer.
Now, you still think that there's a lot of limitations?
There are. You know, it's interesting. A lot of it has to do with infrastructure and how easy it is to do something from scratch. Some time ago, 20, 30 years, I don't know, if you want to build a little mobile robot, well, you need to find some microcontroller that's primarily used for industrial applications, figure out how to make your own circuit board for it and you know, write an assembly code or something and do absolutely everything from total scratch. And now it's just so much more straightforward to have robot operating system operating on a little Raspberry Pi, you know, running Linux and stick a Kinect on there and connect that up with the ROS package. And you can start sticking things together. There's all these sensors, the Arduino program with all the sensor kits and the motor drivers, the first robotics kits, all of these things that make it so much easier to put something together that's going to move around in the world and be really easy to program and to control. And I think that's only going to continue to grow and improve. It's going to allow engineers to do more and more and more.
What are some of the biggest limitations that you see?
The real limitation, I think, for making robots walk and run is kind of the basic science behind it. It's, can you write down an equation that describes the physics of how the thing should move and how it should react to the world? I'll give you an example. When you see a human walking around, you can, with motion capture, measure exactly how they move, right? And so what one might try to do as a first step is just try to build a machine that has all the joints in the same place and then mimic that same motion and just control your machine to follow that same trajectory. But of course, if a person's walking along and you step into a little unexpected hole in the ground, you know, a human's going to react to that and balance well. And a robot that's trying to follow that trajectory that they measured from a human has no capability to do that.
I wouldn't say all humans can balance well. I've seen some pretty incapable humans.
Well, okay, but compare it to a robot, and then you'll really see what incapable is.
I'm just being stupid.
But yeah, but I mean, it's really hard. There's little mechanisms that you can make, little sidestep. You can make a little walker, four-legged walker out of Legos. But this is something that's basically what I would call statically stable. So it's kind of like a table, and it's got four legs. And if you have the center of mass over three of them, you can pick up one of your legs and place it somewhere else, and then move your center of mass, you know, a little bit, and then pick up another leg and set it down somewhere else. So it's pretty straightforward to do something like that because you're just doing kinematics. You're just moving the positions of the limbs and the legs. But what I'm really interested in is dynamics. I want this thing to hop, jump, skip, recover gracefully from a trip, you know, all of the things that you really expect from an agile animal. And, you know, that's harder. There's some biomechanics models, this spring mass model, which is really just like a pogo stick. It's just a mass at the top and a spring underneath it. And if you have that hopping along and you measure the forces it applies on the ground and you measure the motion of the center of mass, that matches pretty closely to all running animals and all walking animals.
A pogo stick.
A pogo stick. So you can't run. If you had two pogo sticks, you can walk, you know. You can't walk with just one leg. But
I can't walk with two pogo sticks.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Well, I mean, what's a kangaroo after all, other than a pogo stick made out of meat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's fundamentally just at a low level. If you kind of ignore all of the morphology, if you ignore the location of the knee and the ankle and all the joints and exactly how it's shaped, and you just look at where is energy flowing in the system and what are the ground reaction forces and what's the center of mass motion, it's fundamentally the same thing as a horse running. You know, a horse has more legs and it's a little more complicated in how its footfalls happen, but pick an ostrich. If an ostrich, you know, versus a kangaroo, it's just switching right leg, left leg, but otherwise it's dynamically the same behavior.
So are you guys studying animals in addition to humans when you're building these robots?
Certainly, because I'm interested not in how a specific individual or a specific animal walks or runs. I'm interested in how walking and running works.
I see.
Fundamentally. And that should be things that are just universally true. So I'm interested in how the animals walk or run the same. And what's the same between a kangaroo and a horse and a human when they're running? And if we can actually understand that, then we're starting to get at some of the fundamental principles. So I don't want to copy an animal. I don't want to look at a kangaroo or something and then build a robot with all the joints and everything in the same place and then get it moving, because that doesn't necessarily mean that we know how it's done or why it is a certain way. So I would describe our stuff as bio-inspired, in that we look at an animal, say, that's the kind of behavior we want. How are they doing that? We come up with some hypothesis or take these hypotheses and ideas from the biomechanics community. We try to represent those concepts and ideas in math models and simulation. And then we try to build a machine and apply engineering in order to actually implement it and understand it, make it work.
So you guys feel like you found the common denominator between the way animals like a horse or an ostrich would run and the way a human would run?
Yeah, you know, I have a good analogy for this. Think of it like a grandfather clock. Everybody's familiar with a pendulum and a grandfather clock and that keeps time, right? And that is called isochronism. And those sorts of dynamics, the fact that a pendulum is, no matter what the amplitude, no matter how wide you swing the pendulum, it's going to have do it in the same amount of time. It's going to have the same frequency. That's sort of a special corner of physics. That is an interesting phenomenon, an interesting dynamical phenomenon that has always existed. It's just part of physics, right? But we didn't notice that until, Galileo, who, that couldn't have been, I don't remember. I wish I could remember. Someone discovered it, okay? And noted that, hey, as you're swinging a weight on the end of a string here, it seems to do it in the same amount of time, no matter how wide you swing it. That's interesting. Maybe it could be used for a clock someday. And then it was later than that, mathematician Christian Huygens actually proved it mathematically and showed it's not just a string on the end of a weight. You have to have this special cycloidal cheeks on the edge of it, and it's not quite a circular arc. It's a cycloidal arc that makes it perfectly isochronic mathematically. So I'd say we're kind of haven't gotten to that point yet with legged locomotion. I think legged locomotion, I view it as a dynamical phenomenon, a special corner of physics where we've made some keen observations about it. We understand what animals are doing at a fairly coarse level. We've demonstrated a lot of those behaviors in simulation and with these simple models like the spring mass model. And it's more complicated than a pendulum. A pendulum is maybe one degree of freedom or two, and maybe we're dealing with five or something like that. It's mm-hmm. a more complex, much richer model for legged locomotion. And I don't think we've gotten to the point yet where the Christian Huygens of the modern era with mathematical or whatever techniques writes down the solution of exactly what is this dynamical phenomenon of legged locomotion. But we're certainly working on it. And that kind of solution, that kind of understanding is still in itself only kind of a beginning. Because think of a grandfather clock now, once it was proven that a pendulum is isochronic and the cycloidal pendulum and all that, there's still hundreds of years of kind of engineering development to come up with the escapements and the clock mechanisms to count up the number of swings, to put it into a human readable interface with a clock face, to keep the pendulum swinging without messing with those dynamics, you know, without interfering with it.
Yeah, you can almost say the same of all of technology, that it all kind of is inspired by something biological or human or just, you know, something natural, and that it takes the technology a minute to kind of catch up and develop to a place where you can actually make a product with it.
Absolutely. So I say we're still, we understand some real fundamentals and some maybe a not quite sufficiently rich model of what the underlying physics is. We understand that. And we're generating and creating a bunch of the engineering best practices to implement this. And we have at least a first couple of examples of machines that really capture those dynamics properly.
It's really impressive what you guys are doing. What would you say makes Agility's robots unique to other robots that are in the marketplace right now?
I'm really trying to go for something that's a lot more biological in how it operates. If you think about any sort of animal, has tendons that are stretchy and leg links that are in just the right place with just the right kind of inertia. So when you have that toe off, the leg kind of swings forward in the right way. And maybe there's not a whole lot of muscle activation that has to be done because the leg naturally wants to swing that way. And I think that we're really aiming for that kind of passive dynamic integration in the behavior of the robot.
What have robotics taught you about animals and humans?
Well, everything we're studying about how to achieve legged locomotion is equally applicable to the science of understanding how animals move. Prosthetic limbs, exoskeletons, all of that is linked. It's the same set of dynamics. So, we've learned an awful lot about how do animals move through applying robotics tools and robotics, optimization and simulation techniques to looking at animal data. Some of my work at the university was all in collaboration with biomechanics researchers and doing simulations and optimizations using the robotics tools and seeing if we can get close matches with data collected from animal experiments.
When you're programming a machine to be able to balance, like when it trips or something like we were saying earlier, what goes into that? That must be such a complicated process.
Sure. So, yeah, it is interesting because, I can show some of the videos of our earlier robot, Atreus, and we had it walking and running over just random terrain. There's no vision or perception. There's no awareness of what the ground is going to be. So the robot can't make any decisions. It can't say, I see something, I'm going to step on it. There was no sensors at all. Nonetheless, it could step up pretty big, step onto pretty big blocks, recover easily, and then unexpectedly again step down the other side. And I think if you're being generous and you told a person, hey, there's probably something rough somewhere in front of you, but you don't know where, you need to run forward now. that's basically what we're doing to the robot. So you have to, you kind of high step it because you don't want to stub your toe on the obstacle. And when you do encounter it, it's pretty surprising what you can encounter when you need to. Using this kind of dynamics, this is why I care about capturing this dynamical phenomenon. It's incredibly stable. It's kind of, I would describe it as like a self-stable system. When you have the dynamics set and some pretty simple control laws set up, it's just running along forward. It hits that step. It bounces up high. It bounces down the other side. And I guess it's analogous to kind of those, the weighted punching bags that have the weight on the bottom. You give it a shove and it just always bounces right back. No decision that has to be made. That's just dynamics. Well, you can do a lot with legged locomotion using just dynamics. But you can't do things like stairs. You can't do things like stepping stones. Mm-hmm. You have to have some perception and path planning in order to decide where you're going to place your feet for that. And integrating those two is challenging because you really want that low level of just robustness and stability where you don't care what the ground looks like. You're going to walk from sidewalk to pavement to grass, and you want to easily handle bumps and rises that you don't necessarily see as you're taking a trail run, okay? People can do this, certainly. And people can run in the dark, and you need your robot to be able to do that kind of thing. But you also want to be able to do the path planning. And normally, when you have sensors and you plan a path, you say, okay, I want my foot to go here, here, and here. But if you think about it, one controller is putting the leg somewhere that it needs to go to balance, and then the other controller says, I want to put my foot here. Those contradict, right? So you kind of need to think about planning within this dynamical space of the robot. You want to be able to modify your stride frequency and your stride length or something, don't know exactly what, in order to, within a couple of steps, have the location on the ground that's appropriate for balance be also the place where you wanted to place your foot. And so that kind of path planning is what's going to be necessary in order to go up and down stairs and do the stepping stones and things like that.
So when a robot trips or something and it's trying to catch its balance, are there specific sensors for reacting to an obstacle that help it? When I trip on something, my weight shifts back and forth. My legs take turns kind of like picking me back upright. It's just mind-boggling to think about all the sensors and equations that must go into getting a machine to do that.
Well, it depends. So if you're running along outside and you step in a little bit of a hole in the ground, it doesn't take any decision-making or awareness, right? That has to be something that is handled just by the robustness of the system. That has to be part of the dynamics, that it just recovers from that as a feature of it being self-stable. If, on the other hand, you say, are trying to swing your foot forward and you stub your toe and it sticks, you know, you hit a rock with your swing leg, mm-hmm. You have to have a really fast reflex that really doesn't have the luxury of kind of carefully evaluating what's going on right now. You can't say, oh, I've just stubbed my toe. I'm going to scan the ground, do a plan, all that computational effort, replan a trajectory for my foot, and then do something novel. You don't have time for that. So you kind of have to have just dirt simple reaction, kind of reflex reactions. If you stub your toe, just, you know, retract, quickly lift it higher, swing forward, and try and get that foot down on the ground. And you can see people doing this sometimes, and maybe that initial heuristic doesn't work. So there's 1, 2, 3 tries and they fall. And that's that, you know, that can happen. So, and then there's other things which will be, you really need to plan a couple of steps ahead. Like if you get a good shove and you're on a boulder field, you're looking down at the ground and where your feet are going, and you know, very quickly you're thinking about your next 2, 3 steps. That takes much higher level reasoning and planning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
And you see all the whole range of those kinds of things in different animals. If you, you know, the studies of cockroaches, Bob Full at Berkeley has done a lot of work with studying cockroach locomotion. And they do things like putting little cannons on the back of the cockroach to give them a huge shove sideways and see how they recover and respond. Or
really?
You know, yeah, there's a video online of this. And they'll do things too. Like,
I don't know why that makes me laugh.
Oh, it's hilarious, right? You see the
just a little cockroach blowing
video.
Around.
Yeah, you see the slow motion video and this huge, you know, big explosion out the side from this little cannon that's super glued to the back of a cockroach.
I give this 5 years until PETA is pissed.
They also do things like they just have little holes in the ground and they have a electrode going in a little cockroach brain to see what is the animal thinking as it's going over this. And the cockroach doesn't even recognize that its foot has hit or missed the ground until long since that stance phase is passed. And the leg is already swinging back for the next stride before their brain even gets the nerve sensor data to say, hey, that foot just wasn't on the ground right there. So clearly that's something that's just the fact that they have a certain kind of compliance and stiffness and springiness in their legs and the certain shape that they're going and the self-stability of the dynamics is what handles most of those kinds of disturbances. And cockroaches don't have the high-level planning that humans do for calculating where they place their feet. The things are much, much simpler, like just a reaction to how the antenna run into something, they lift up their forelimbs so that when they smack into it, they're likely to slide right up over the top of it. That's it. It's that kind of really simple response. But larger animals like humans can do much more careful, much more planned sorts of behaviors. And we need our robots to get around in human environments and interact with humans. So they're going to need to have that whole control hierarchy, those low-level self-stability, the reflexes, and the higher-level planning capability.
Man, thinking about all this stuff in such mathematical terms on such a specific level must make you so jaded towards everyday life. If I were you, I would just be like, I would just be like, so I would just see everything as like math or something. Do you think you see things differently than other people because you've spent so much time like observing the equations of movements of joints and things like that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people take legged locomotion for granted because
I'm saying. Yeah,
it's just so common. You look around and everybody's obviously, why is this so hard? And I see it in movies and I see my kids learn it. And some animals are born able to walk and run. And, you know, what's the big deal here? But, you know, people wouldn't necessarily say that the operation of our brain is incredibly simple because it's common. So I don't know. It's just an impression. But I would say that when I'm looking at how animals and humans are walking and running, it's more interesting.
When you're pouring like a bowl of cereal or something, are you thinking about like the arc and the equation that your wrist is making in conjunction with your, you're not thinking about that stuff?
No, but I do like, you know, it is fun to go to the zoo and watch the ostriches walking and running around and see what kind of behaviors they can do and think about how is that working and why are they doing that and what can or can't they do? And
so your mind's always on like that.
No, I've got kids. I take vacations.
When your kids are running around on the beach on vacation, you're not observing their knees and stuff like that?
I've got a few good videos of my daughters as they were learning to walk and run and learning to navigate obstacles. I had my youngest, Anne, run back and forth a bunch of times over a step up, and just it was really interesting to look at how she really didn't plan her footsteps very well for the drop step. And so half the time she would get there and stop because she wasn't really prepared for that step down, and then step down slowly and then run again. Half the time the stride was just sort of right, so she didn't have to slow down and could keep going. It was pretty interesting. And then a year later, she knows how to plan ahead a couple of strides in order to handle it every single time. So that's how I daydream.
So how do we know robots, when they're ubiquitous, when they're everywhere, everybody has one, how do we know it's not just going to make people super lazy?
Why do you make that assumption? I think people probably will be. No, people have ambitions and interests and things they want to do and things they want to achieve. I mean, as it is now, we have to do so much less, I don't know, hunting, gathering, growing of food, you name it. It's already our lives are dramatically easier than they were before. I really don't think that people will do less because they don't have to. I think that when people are freed up from a lot of the chores that they have to do, just we get to all achieve so much more. We'd never be able to be manufacturing automobiles and computers and things like that if we had to spend 60% of our time or 80% of our time acquiring food.
Yeah, you're definitely right about that. Yeah. I mean, the robots have machinery, technology in general, was birthed out of that free time.
And robotics is no different. I mean, robotics is simply another tool that is really a labor-saving method. Yeah, and it builds on itself. The more technology, people only develop technology because they're lazy, because they want to achieve something, that, you know, they want the robot or they want the machinery to do something for them that makes it easier. And then additional free time allows them to invent more things. I just don't think robots are any different from any of the other labor-saving devices that we've invented and created over the last 1,000 years or more. I kind of have this vision of how legged locomotion, just think about it in terms of how logistics is going to change things. And just take the kind of mental leap from Amazon Prime now, as it is today, to everybody having access to that with every company and having it be much faster and much less expensive to do that kind of thing. You know, what do you want to have delivered to your house instead of driving to the store for? anytime you want some food or groceries or any of the basics that you're going to want to get, why would you go to the store if it's just really easy to say, hey, Alexa, I need some toothpaste, you know, next time you're by, or that kind of thing.
Right.
And yeah, a lot of my weekends involve getting the kids in the car and, you know, going out and doing shopping for necessities, not things that are fun to shop for. They're not things the kids don't like, getting in the car seat and going to the grocery store.
Yeah, I get that. I get that one.
Yeah. And recently we've done some things like there's this new click list where we can call ahead and have our groceries ready for us. And we just have to drive and pick them up. And even that is pretty convenient. But boy, it would be easier if they would just drop it off at our house. And beyond that, I can imagine all these businesses that are going to just deliver the ingredients for whatever you wanted to cook that night, or just deliver dinner. And just the whole gamut of things. You know, like, why would you go to Walmart if everything that's there can easily be delivered at your house? Walmart is basically a warehouse that is easy for people to navigate the aisles, and it's air conditioned and it's well lit, and there's a huge parking area outside. And you're basically relying on the people to do their own kind of pick and place to select the things off of the various sections of this warehouse.
Right. They're hunting, kind of.
Yeah. And there's no reason to require people to go into the warehouse and do their own pick and place to find the components and the products of the things that they needed, and then transport it individually in everybody's individual cars back to their homes. You know, and I think once the autonomous cars are out on the road and we've got the legged robots that are hopping out of these cars and being able to go into the apartment buildings and upstairs and, you know, through the doorways and things like that, I think it changes weekend traffic patterns and shopping patterns and how cities are laid out and people's free time and a lot of stuff. It's really a pretty significant impact there. Even today, just the logistics is like $1 trillion market. What is it? Some 20 to 40% of the cost of any manufactured good is logistics.
Wow.
So if you can just make logistics, just getting stuff from point A to point B, from a manufacturer to a customer without quite as many middlemen and steps in the road and warehouses and things like that, it really makes everything less expensive, which effectively makes everybody wealthier. It gives people additional free time because they don't have to do all of their own pick and place. It changes traffic patterns and reduces energy costs, because now you don't need to maintain air conditioning and lighting and widely spaced aisles in these big warehouses meant for people to come in and get the things. There are a lot of impacts just for thinking about legged locomotion in logistics alone.
How many years do you think we are from like a utopia where robots are just doing everything for us and life is perfect?
Well, I mean, it's never going to be like that, you know? There's a lot of policy questions too about whether it's going to go really, really well or have some real challenges.
Like, what challenges do you foresee?
People have talked for a long time about how many truckers are going to be out of business with the autonomous vehicles.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, we've got to figure out the economical problems, but there's the universal basic income is a good, a lot of people are talking about that idea. What do you think about that?
I don't know about that. And that may be extreme too. I was just reading an article that says there's an extreme shortage of truckers right now. In fact,
wow.
You know, we think that this is going to be a problem, but on the other hand, with as many, you know, things as people are ordering online and buying and the logistics starting to really increase, they just can't hire enough truckers to date. So maybe that's going to take a big flip-flop and change, but it's not going to happen overnight. It's not like 4 years from now, all of a sudden, we need no truckers.
You think it's 50 years, 100 years till like life is like way, way different? Or you think it's, you know, how if you had to guess?
I just think it's a continuum, just like it has been. I mean, things are different now than they were in the 90s, than they were in the 70s, than they were in the 50s.
Yeah.
And it's just going to keep on going like that, as far as I can tell.
But the last 10 years have been dramatically different than, you know, anything before it.
Yeah, but don't you think that 1960 was dramatically different from 1950? Was different from 1940, you know?
Not as drastic as, you know, 1997 to 2018.
That's 20 years.
Yeah, that's 20 years. But I think that what I'm getting at is that the last 20 years has probably been the biggest change that the world has ever seen.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think a lot of changes have been happening and they're going to keep on happening.
What do you make of movies like Terminator and Ex Machina? Do you think they're just paranoid, or do you think that there's some validity to that, possibilities like that?
Yeah, no, they're a little bit silly. I mean, I really value these movies because it's important for people to worry about this stuff before it's a problem. And I think that's exactly what's going on. You know, as a company at Agility Robotics, we have just a policy. We're not going to put any weapons on robots. We don't want to be a part of that. And we're not going to do it. But I'd say there's a long-term judgment-based caveat. And I'll get there in a minute. If you think about autonomous vehicles, they're going to need to start making decisions about when something is unavoidable. Do they smash into a tree and kill the occupant, or do they run into a pedestrian? You know, they're going to have to make ethical choices. And the only way to do that is to have kind of a set of rules, a rules of engagement, specific criterion that allow you to quantify ethical decisions. And that is going to be a long time coming, and it's going to be a long evolution, and it's going to be a long process to figure that out. I think the movie iRobot was kind of based around that, the ethics of how to make choices how they impact people.
Do you think you can put ethics into an equation?
Well, I don't know if I would call it an equation, but a policy. It's quantified some way where, I mean, it has to be. That's what law is, in fact.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
It's far from perfect, right? But a lot of our ethics and a lot of our morals are codified in laws. And it's a continually evolving and, I hope and I believe, improving process for how that's done and how it's evaluated. And, you know, I think robots are going to have to really push that to be quantified even further. In the distant future, I can imagine that if the appropriate rules of engagement, you know, think about drones. And in military applications, right? Right now, it's a real problem because the drones make it so easy to cause such damage and harm and hurt with, you know, the soldiers being removed from danger. And that's really a problem because you don't have that human judgment on the ground right there. But to be clear, human judgment is flawed and soldiers and humans on the ground make mistakes as well. And I think it's possible for robots that have really gone through this process of having carefully quantified and codified rules of engagement and how it's allowed to use force and in exactly which situations, and have it be always recorded and have every single incident go through three layers of inquiry and review. You know, I can imagine a scenario in which a drone or a robot is going to behave more ethically on the whole and make fewer mistakes than individual humans would.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
It'll be a while. And it's something we have to do, right? It's not a given. It's something we have to do.
I mean, Google Maps is already better at telling me which route to take than my own brain. I mean, there's no way a human could be as efficient as Google because it's taking into account so many factors that humans can't even perceive. So, I think that's a really good point that you just made. Do you think robots will ever be self-aware and autonomous?
I mean, autonomous, sure.
Like completely autonomous, though. Like, you know, autonomous to the point where they could, you know, disobey.
Oh, well, our robots disobey us all the time.
I mean, that's not what I wanted to hear.
Well, it's sort of we made a mistake in something or other. It did something we didn't expect. I guess that's how I would say it disobeyed. It did something we didn't really anticipate for it to do.
How often does that happen?
I mean, all the time, because we're programming it, we're creating it, and constantly making mistakes in how we write the controller or have a sign error here or there or something like that, and the robot just doesn't do what we anticipated it to do. And that's I don't know, could be viewed as disobeying.
So, for the sake of argument,
pretty distant. I don't really believe in this singularity that's going to happen in 5 years, and then all of a sudden robots are going to just take away. I really think that AI and the intelligence are just really more capable and useful tools for us, and that it's humans that have the intentions and the creativity to use these tools to do interesting things. They're just more and more powerful tools for humans. That's what it is.
That's how I'm hoping to look at it. You know, I really don't know because I don't work in this field. That's why I'm talking to you right now. But you know, it's interesting hearing your take on it. And that's, you know, technology brings us tools. That's what it does. So a robot should be no different in that respect. It's just interesting to think about how, you know, robots are going to be capable. They're going to be the most advanced tool we've ever built, especially if they have, you know, AI running on it and stuff like that. And, you know, when you say that they do things that are unpredictable all the time due to overlooking something or making a mistake, I mean, who's to say that a robot couldn't do something crazy or just flip out or just like go, you know, storming into someone's house or, you know, killing something or, you know, who's to say that something like that could not happen? How can we guarantee that?
I mean, you can't. It's just like a mental illness or something. You can't guarantee it with people either. You can just try to make things that are more reliable and more capable than what we kind of accept as a standard acceptable risk. Think of AIs as like a chess playing algorithm, right? Or a checkers playing. I teach this applied robotics class in Oregon State, and we had checkers playing robots. It turns out checkers is just a solved game. I mean, the solution exists. So for any game state of any combination of where the game can be with the checkers on the board, the robot can know what is the optimal path to play. So it's, you're playing against this this solved game. It's not possible to beat the machine. So if you want to be playing, you're playing checkers with your cousin and it's a real rivalry and you'd rather win, you can use your laptop as a tool to tell you where to move and you're going to win every time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what AIs are. You're going to use the AI as a tool to do something better than you for some fairly specific task. But I don't see any evidence of machines, you know, wanting to do something the way that people do or having the same kind of creativity or motivations or self-initiative or any of that. They're tools. They're complex calculators that are going to help us do more and more.
So in the future, when we're when people are plugging their brains into the neural lace and things like that, and AI and robotics are kind of hand in hand at that point, with as logical as computers are, you know, they don't have emotion, they don't have intuition. Is there any danger that they could potentially rule us, for a lack of a better phrase? You know, if we're all plugged into this digital world and, you know, we're kind of one with computers, wouldn't they kind of have full control of our minds?
You know, I think the danger is not so much that the computers are going to have control. It's that a small number of people are going to have control with this very powerful tool. And that's already what we started to see in the recent election cycles and with Cambridge Analytica and the way that advertising was with big data was very specifically and carefully targeted through Facebook and things like that, really had an influence. And that is not going to get better until people very much proactively start creating, you know, policy and methods to understand how that influences and how it impacts and how to counter it.
So in your mind, robots are not ever going to be entirely autonomous from external control. In other words, the companies who own them will always have full control of them. That's how you see it?
Oh, I wouldn't go so far as to say the companies who built them have full control over them. I mean, there's lots of unintended consequences. I don't think Facebook in any way intended to have so many of the negative consequences that they've had, you know, along with all the positive things that they were really dreaming about. I mean, there's a lot that's fantastic about these tools and excellent, and it's what the engineers were really going for. And, you know, keeping in touch with your families and your friends and, you know, sharing the pictures and all that stuff. But the kind of the negative influence it's had on people is the unintended consequence and the way some have maybe abused the power of having that that influence over people is an unintended consequence in a problem. And that kind of thing, I think, is going to crop up again and again and again, and possibly to greater and greater impact because these tools are becoming more and more powerful. It's going to be easier for a smaller number of people to have a greater amount of influence, I think.
In closing, is there like one thing that people always fail to ask you in situations like this? I'm sure that some of these questions are questions you hear all the time. Is there anything that is interesting to you about robotics that you never really get to talk about, or something that's insightful, or, you know, in closing, anything like that?
The thing is, a lot of people can be concerned about robots in the future because it's new, right? But and it's harder to imagine what are all of the really positive outcomes that are much, much more likely. And I think that viewing robots as and robotics and automation and all this as really allowing us to do so much more than we could before and just give us a lot more freedom, basically, is what really excites me about robotics having impact on lives. I think, you know, Agility Robotics, coming back to our company, doing our piece of the problem, which is mobility in the real world and legged locomotion, I sincerely hope that when I'm 90 and, you know, I'd really kind of need some help around the house, that the, say, the Sony robot that I buy that is the home helper robot that is connected up to the whole Google ecosystem for, you know, speech recognition and talking to it and information, and is an Agility Robotics mobility solution. It's our legs, it's our arms, it's our controls that enable all of these different companies to come together to build a product. And I buy the Sony robot that's in my home that's helping me carry my groceries, helping me, you know, talk with my kids via this telepresence interface, kind of as if they were there, and I'm still going around the house doing my thing and helping me up and down the stairs and things like that. That's the kind of thing where I would really feel like we were successful as a company, as if this robot is kind of a, just allows me to be more free and not rely on other humans. And it's an affordable way to take care of myself. It's a tool that I can use to make my life better. That's really what excites me about robotics.
How much power do these robots take up? What's their battery life like? And then how long do they take to charge?
Our robots take maybe a couple hundred watts at present, with a lot of room for improvement. On our battery pack, it can go all day if you're kind of doing intermittent things.
Mm-hmm. What about environmental impact? Like, is that the energy? I'm trying to get an idea for how much energy these things consume.
I mean, very, very little. I mean, okay, to put it in perspective, we have two computers on board, like a small PC style computer, and those two computers take up half of the power of the robot when it's operating. So we could really reduce the amount of power that the robot requires just by using a more power efficient computer, something like is used in a smartphone. So the locomotion itself, because of how we do the passive dynamics, because of how we incorporate the compliance and the springs and all that, it's really very efficient.
Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you making the time for this. I encourage everybody to check out agilityrobotics.com. Check out the stuff they're working on. It's really cool. The Cassie robot is pretty sweet. How much do these things cost? You know, are they pretty affordable?
So when we're starting to build these and actually put them out in markets, they're going to be about the same price as, say, a mid-range motorcycle.
Okay, not too bad.
There's nothing in the manufacturing that is any more difficult than that.
What do you think about robots? Are we going to be friends with them? Are they just going to remain tools that we use to make life easier? Share your thoughts with us in the comments. If you're watching on YouTube, that's a great place to join in the conversation. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. You can shoot me an email if you want. hello@spellboundshow.com. Would love to hear from you. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am, and I'll see you guys next Monday.